Good morning.
It's good to be with you. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving. I know we did. We enjoyed our Thanksgiving weekend, and I'm so glad to be here. Before I begin, I have a couple stories to tell you. Once upon a time, there was a man who was given the vacation opportunity of a lifetime, an all-expenses paid trip on the most luxurious cruise liner in the Caribbean. Free Caribbean cruise, his expenses to and from the port of call would be reimbursed by a very generous donor. All the excursions that cruise liners offer, those were all free. Free diving lessons, free swimming with the dolphins. They were even going to helicopter him out to the Mayan pyramids so he could avoid the bumpy three-hour Jeep ride that the cruise liner normally does. The most luxurious liner, the best food prepared by internationally famous chefs, and his benefactor even did the favor of booking the cruise 6 months in advance, so the man had plenty of time to get to arrange for time off of work. But when it came time to go on the cruise, the man decided to stay home because he'd rather put in yet another full week of work at his job. Once upon a time in a galaxy, in a state far, far away from here, a long time ago, in a state far, far away, there was a citizen who was invited by the President of the United States to come live at the White House for a week. And the invitation, it was written personally by the President. It included being flown to Andrews Air Force Base on Air Force One and then helicoptered into the White House on Marine One. The way the president had set up the week, this man who was invited was encouraged to spend his mornings poking around the White House, asking any questions he wanted of the top-level aide that would be assigned to escort him. In the afternoon, every afternoon, there was a private one-on-one, one-hour meeting with the president. The president wanted to hear his views on foreign and domestic policies. And then in the evening, every evening, the president gave a banquet for special guests, and he was invited to those as well. And upon reading the invitation, the man was kind of surprised at how personal it was, how personable it was. The president made him feel really welcome. In fact, the president noted in his letter that he was aware that the man voted against him in the last election, but he wanted to have the pleasure of his company and hear his views anyway. There was only one condition. When he was in the White House, especially at official meetings, they wanted him to wear appropriate attire. They wanted him to wear a suit and a tie, especially to the banquets and to the other meetings with the president. And there was some concern on the White House on their part about them. They didn't know how the man's finances were. And so they sent him, enclosed in the letter, enough money to buy a Giorgio Armani, plus extra for the cost of going to a tailor. That was the only condition. They wanted him to come in appropriate attire. And a sunny summer day came when he got to go spend a week at the White House. He was invited well over 6 months in advance, so he had plenty of time to get the suit. And a sunny summer day came in D.C. The man arrived, but when he stepped off of Marine One, he stepped off in a raggedy shirt and shorts. He was unshaven, and he was wearing flip-flops. And there was no suit in his luggage. Those stories are my attempts to kind of put into modern terms the shock of the parable that we're going to study this morning. This parable is one of the most dramatic parables our Lord taught. And it was addressed in a very specific way to his audience in a very specific historical context. But it speaks to us, we'll see this at the end of the parable, it speaks to us as Gentiles who live in the church age directly. It was directed to us as well as to Jesus' original audience. This parable is found in Matthew 22, starting in verse 1. Please turn there in your Bible, Matthew 22, verse 1. And while you're turning there, let me remind you of the historical context this parable comes to us in. This is Tuesday of the Passion Week. The day before, on Monday, Jesus had driven out the money changers and those who were selling animals in the temple. And then after doing that, after cleaning the place up, he healed the blind and the lame, and he taught the people about the kingdom. He came back on Tuesday morning, And he's teaching the people again. And while he's teaching the people, the chief priest and the elders of the people come and interrupt what he's trying to do to ask him by what authority he does these things. Now, Jesus could have given them a very direct answer to their question. On other occasions, he had said very publicly and very overtly that he was God's son and the promised Messiah that they had been looking for. But what Jesus does, and I won't re-preach that sermon, but they came trying to trap him. They wanted to make him look ridiculous in front of the people. And instead of Jesus just giving them a straight answer to their question, which he could have done, he gives them a counter question that traps them and makes them look ridiculous in front of the people. I mean, if you can't figure out whether the ministry of John the Baptist was from God or from men, how are you going to figure out whether the ministry of Jesus is from God or from men? And I think that the point in all this is that Jesus chose to trap them because of their evil motives. Because this is the idea. Scripture says this in multiple places, especially the Psalms. With the shrewd, God shows himself to be shrewd. You come trying to trap and embarrass Jesus, he'll make sure you walk away being the one embarrassed. And so that's what Jesus does. He gives a counter question that shows the chief priests aren't competent to be questioning him. And then he turns on them and he gives a trilogy of parables that confront them. Now, these parables, they teach multiple lessons. They're great for us to learn from. They speak to us, people of faith, as well as confronting the chief priest who didn't believe in him. There are a lot of good lessons. But the one thing they all share in common, the one common denominator they all have, is that they include judgment on the chief priest. They're parables that where the chief priests are told they will be judged for their unbelief. The first parable was the parable of the two sons. The second was the parable of the landowner. And now today, we're going to look at the parable of the wedding feast. And this parable of the wedding feast is the climax to the whole thing. It's the big conclusion. And these parables are rich. They teach multiple lessons. But if you want to reduce them to their simplest form, I think we could say it this way. Jesus says to the chief priest, in essence, "You've rejected me. Moses and the prophets, they spoke of me. My miracles validate my messianic claims, but for 3 years now, you've rejected me, and now God rejects you." That's the essence of these parables. But there's still things that people of faith can learn from as well, other than just being warned about unbelief. So let's look at it together. Matthew says, chapter 22, verse 1, "Jesus spoke to them again in parables." Jesus was a master at telling parables. What he would do is he would take something very familiar and known to the people, and he would move from what was known to the unknown. He would take a physical reality they could relate to, and then he would compare it to a spiritual reality that maybe they weren't as familiar with. And when Jesus speaks in this parable, he says, here's the parable actually, verse 2, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son." Now, when Jesus speaks of the kingdom of heaven, he's speaking about the realm or dominion of redemption. Maybe I could say it this way. Yes, it's true that God is the creator of all things, and as the creator of all things, he owns all things. There's a very literal way in which we can say God is king of the entire universe, period. But when we speak about the kingdom of heaven, we're talking about the realm of salvation, the realm of redemption, as opposed to the kingdom of darkness that God has allowed for a time, for a limited time, to be controlled by Satan and peopled with those who reject him. Okay, so when he speaks about the kingdom of heaven, he's talking about the sphere of God's rule by grace and salvation. And in this parable, the king of the realm gives a wedding feast for his son. Now, in those days, weddings were a way bigger deal than they are to us today. Yes, they did have a wedding ceremony about as long as our wedding ceremonies go, unless the pastor is too verbose. But it was the reception that set them apart. Their receptions lasted days. Historians tell us it was not uncommon for the wedding what we would consider a reception, to last for a week. And it was full of feasting and banqueting and food. It was a time of happiness and joy. And the Greek word, I found this interesting, as I was reading Matthew, the Greek word he used for wedding feast throughout the passage, he just kind of naturally goes back and forth from plural to singular. And I think that shows you sort of in the Greek mindset, yes, it's a wedding feast to celebrate a single occasion, the marriage of these two people, but the feast takes place over multiple days where there's multiple banquets. There's a big banquet every night, and there's these amazing meals for breakfast and lunch. It's feastings, it's banquets, plural. And he just kind of moves back and forth from the plural to the singular because of the way that they did their wedding feasting. And the wedding feast in our parable is not just a feast thrown for commoners or some upper middle class family in the realm. This is a wedding feast put on by the king. So Jesus uses the one event that was the highlight of family life. Everybody could relate to that. Everybody had been to a wedding. And he also makes the wedding feast one that's put on by a king. The kingdom of heaven is like the greatest celebration imaginable, put on by the most wealthy person imaginable for the most honorable person imaginable. And I'm so glad, if I could just stop right here and make an observation, I'm so glad that Jesus compares the kingdom of heaven to a wedding feast. Because the other event, the other big event in family life is funerals. If he had said the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a funeral, I mean, I'd have a crisis of faith. I'd have to resign from pastoral ministry. But that's not what the kingdom of heaven is like. It's a happy thing. It is a happy, joyful fact, hope-filled fact, that the kingdom of heaven is a celebration of the Son. It's like a wedding feast. And soon, this is a reminder, soon we are going to be at the marriage supper of the Lamb, feasting with God the Father, celebrating the Son. And it will be a joyous time. In fact, it will be a marriage feast that is happier than any wedding you've ever been to. It's a joyful, hope-filled, happy thing that the kingdom of heaven is like a wedding feast. But let's look back at the parable. I'm getting ahead of myself here. I just was really happy about that. I needed some good news this week, and that was good news. Let's get back to the parable, though. Verse 3, the king sent out his slaves to call those who had been invited to the wedding feast. Now, let me put this in context for you. The Greek phrase that we translate, those who had been invited, it literally reads, the already having been invited ones. That's the way it reads in Greek. And the invitation to all proper wedding feasts were sent out months in advance. These kinds of events were planned 6 months to a year in advance. In other words, the king didn't spring this on his subjects at the last minute, during harvest season when they're trying to bring the crops in or something like that. This is something they knew about well in advance. They had all the time in the world to clear off their calendars for this week of fasting. But look at what happens at the end of verse 3. But the already having been invited ones were unwilling to come. That's shocking. Let that sink in for a moment. These people are invited by the king to the greatest celebration he's ever going to throw for the kingdom. The food would be unparalleled. The lodging at the king's palace would be luxurious and comfortable. And when we read further into the story, we find out that this king is a good king. He's a really gracious, nice, patient kind of guy. And the crown prince, his son, is a person worthy of being celebrated. And yet they turn the opportunity down. I mean, who does that? The king honors you with an invitation to the palace for the biggest celebration you'll ever attend, and people turn him down. I mean, just, it doesn't make sense to me. It would, just the event in and of itself would be something you would want to go to in the first place. But I got some other lines of reasoning that just drives me nuts. The food is one of them. Guys, we eat so much better than ancient people ate. The food that's going to be at this banquet is better than anything we commoners eat. And I'm such a mercenary. You know, I get so bent out of shape about our grocery budget that's just like, hey, bring the kids. Let's eat on the king's dime for a week. I'm all for ribeye steak on the king. I'm all for that. The food would have been amazing. But, you know, there also is another thing that I want to be careful how hard I push on this, because he's a very gracious king. But there's also the authority issue. This guy is your king. If he asks you to do something, if he invites you to a wedding, he's not asking you to go die in some foreign war for him, fighting a war against somebody. He's asking you to a celebration at the palace. I mean, that just seems like a no-brainer to me. You go. Maybe I could put it to you this way. I am a fan of The Princess Bride. And there's this character in The Princess Bride, Vicini, right? And when he thinks he's won the battle of wits with the protagonist, what does he say, right? He says, you fell victim to one of the most classic blunders, the most famous of which is never get involved in a land war in Asia, but only slightly less well known is this, never go in against a Sicilian when death is on the line, right? So I would like to take Vicini's wisdom and add a third one of my own. Never get involved in a land war in Asia. Don't go in against a Sicilian when death is on the line. And how about this? Don't say no to Middle Eastern kings. How about that? Especially in the first century. Look, you want to say no to a British king after the Magna Carta has been written? We'll find a baron that you can go hide behind. Okay, but you don't say no to Middle Eastern kings. This just doesn't, even from an authority perspective, this just doesn't make sense. But if you think that the unwillingness of the people to go to this is shocking, look at what happens next. It gets even more shocking. Verse 4. Again, the king sent out his slaves, saying, behold, I've prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fatted livestock are all butchered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast. This king is a cool customer. The unwillingness of the people to come is an insult to him and his son, but he gives everybody a second chance. He even reasons with them. Hey, my food's prepared. I killed the animals. We got great food. He even reasons with them. This is a nice king. There's a patience here and a graciousness which is not common among most kings. I don't know how much history you like to read in. I love to read history. Most kings have been pretty evil men. I agree with the founding fathers that absolute power corrupts absolutely. But this king, he's a pretty gracious, patient guy. But look what happens in verse 5. But the invited ones paid no attention and went their way, one to his own farm and another to his business. These people are, I guess the best word I could find for it is indifferent. There's just an indifference here. And now the story, I think, is getting really far-fetched. I mean, this is just foolish. You have a farmer who says, in essence, no, I'd rather go to the monotonous farm labor I do by hand every day. I'm going to skip the celebration. And you go to another guy. He wants to go to his emporium. That's the Greek word. He has a small business. This guy's a small business owner. He owns a shop. I'd rather go to my shop. It's just foolishness. There's a picture here of selfish preoccupation with your own enterprises. These people forfeit a glory and a beauty and a joy in the celebration that could have been theirs. The invitation they received was one of the highest honors that they could have ever had bestowed on them, and they just don't care. But it gets even worse. Verse 6, and the rest of the invited ones seized his slaves and mistreated them and killed them. Now you have outright hostility. They abuse some of the slaves. They murder some of them. I mean, this is just madness. These people, it's like they're premeditating ways to get themselves killed. And we need to stop here, I think, and talk about the meaning of this parable. I think it's all pretty obvious. The king is God the Father. The crown prince is his son, Jesus, Messiah. The ones who were invited to the wedding feast originally are God's chosen people, Israel, the apple of God's eye. God promised to bless all the nations of the world through them and to bless all Gentiles that are willing to bless them, bless the descendants of Abraham. God used his people Israel as the channel to reach the world with the message of salvation and righteousness. But when it came time to celebrate the Son, what did the nation do? Many of them were indifferent, and you see that especially illustrated in cities like Chorazin and Bethsaida and Capernaum, where Jesus Jesus made Capernaum his headquarters for ministry for the 3 years of his public ministry, even though he was traveling a lot. He wasn't there very often, but Capernaum was just indifferent to him. And others were outright hostile. They had a history of being hostile to the king's slaves, of abusing the prophets and murdering them. And if you think I'm being too hard on the Jews, let me add that the history of Gentiles has been no different. The gospel has gone forth to the majority of Gentile nations now. And what have the majority of the Gentiles done? I would submit to you, the majority of the Gentiles have been indifferent. They're too interested in their farms. They're too interested in their small business. They don't necessarily think that their own behavior is offensive to the king. They're not trying to offend him. They're just not interested. One of my mentors is the father of 4 adult children, and 3 of them are walking with the Lord, and we had a chance to catch up by Skype a few weeks ago, and I've been praying for one of his sons who's wayward, and he had a heart-to-heart with his son recently where he came up before the conversation. He came up with like 5 reasons that people typically reject Christ, and are you angry with God? Do you just not care? Do you think Christianity is wrong and there's some other religion that makes more sense to you? You know, which is it? And the son said, basically, Dad, I'm not angry at God. I really don't feel like I'm hostile to God. I'm just not interested. I'm interested in other stuff. It's indifference. And I would submit to you that the response of millions of Gentiles across the globe has been indifference to Christ. I think it comes naturally to human nature. I mean, part of our fallenness is we tend to value the physical more than the spiritual. We tend to value the temporal more than the eternal. We find relationships with other human beings more satisfying than relationship with God. We tend to gravitate towards what we think we need or what we desire, not what God says we need. It just comes naturally to human nature, and I think it leads to an indifference. But other people are hostile. And I believe that's illustrated best in false religions. It's false religions that have been the most hostile to Christianity. And the king in this parable, he's been patient. He invited all his guests in advance. He gave them plenty of time to plan to come. He sent his slaves out to bring them in. When they refused and insulted him and his son, he still graciously sent out slaves again. He gave him a second chance, but then they murdered some of his slaves. And it was outright rebellion. So the king, he goes, and he can't let these murderers go free and still be a just king. The king is patient, but even his patience has a limit. And so verse 7 says, the king was enraged, and he sent his armies and destroyed those murderers and set their city on fire. I believe that's a prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem. I think Jesus is giving a prophecy in parabolic form about what's going to happen to Jerusalem in the future. In 66 AD, the Jews revolted from Roman rule, and the Romans brought armies in and killed, I think most historians estimate, 2 million Jews died. And in that conquest in 70 AD, the Romans burned the temple and destroyed the city of Jerusalem. And this is a parabolic prophecy that Jesus is more explicit and overt about on other occasions. But here you get the prophecy in the middle of a parable. But that's not the end of the story. The story moves on. Verse 8. Then the king said to the slaves, the wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Go therefore to the main highways, and as many as you find there, invite to the wedding feast. Everything is ready, but there's no one at the party. So the king sends his slaves out on all the thoroughfares to just invite everybody. Invite anybody who's willing to come. Anyone the slaves find can come. And I think it's interesting here. Here's the surprising thing. If you're picturing this story with a human king, he probably didn't invite the whole realm, right? He invited the best and the brightest, his nobles, probably more wealthy people in the kingdom, typically. And there probably was some premeditation about who's invited and who's not originally. But now, the invitation is made and with no discrimination. It's completely indiscriminate. And I kind of wonder, in the story, you know, if you're a slave, if you want to say to the king, like, what do you mean, anyone? I mean, look, do you get out of the palace walls much? I mean, there's some people that you really probably don't. I don't want to invite everyone. You don't literally mean everyone. Like the king, no, everyone. Invite everyone you find. Invite them to the feast. And what it pictures is the spread of the gospel to the Gentiles. The gospel goes forth to Gentiles, and the message goes out to everybody. Whether you're respectable or not, a criminal, a law-abiding, a good person by human standards, a bad person according to your culture, the message of the gospel goes out to everyone. And so the slaves obey, and verse 10 we learn, those slaves went out into the streets and they gathered together all they found, both evil and good, and the wedding hall was filled with dinner guests. This pictures what the Apostle Paul talks about later in Romans 11:12 when he says, speaking of the Jewish people, if their transgression is riches for the world and their failure riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their fulfillment be? If God used Israel's rejection of Messiah to then spread the gospel to the Gentile nations and bless the Gentiles, how much more will Gentiles be blessed in the future day, in the end times, when all Israel turns to God in obedience? The blessing will be even greater. God is not done, even though God is working primarily through the church in this age, God is not done with his people Israel. He has a future for them and a plan for them. And on that future day, when they are all obedient and turn to the Lord, it'll be a day of even greater blessing on the Gentile nations. And at this point in the parable, what we see is that those who were originally not invited now get this invitation they never expected. They never could have expected or hoped to receive this invitation. And now they get an invitation. And when the slaves gathered all the people they found into the wedding hall, there were the good and the bad. Now, what does that mean? Why do bad people get to be in this wedding hall? Well, the good and the bad that are being referred to here are the good and the bad according to human estimation. Just morality as fallen humans think of morality. Maybe we could put it this way. Good, law-abiding, nice people who are respectable get invited. And then there are some people who are shady, not really law-abiding, rougher people. They make it into the banquet hall as well. And it's illustrative of the gospel. When God sends forth the gospel message, it goes forth to everybody. There's no text in the New Testament that tells us to discriminate against people who in our estimation are the bad people and not let them hear the gospel message. Let me give you a perfect illustration. There is no faction in Christianity trying to stop chaplains from giving the gospel in prisons. Nobody's doing that, right? Because we go to everybody, including the people in the prisons, who we think probably the majority of them are probably guilty, right? We don't stop that. The gospel goes to everybody. And so that brings up the question then, if bad people get in, what does the king mean about... how is one worthy to come to this feast, especially if bad people come? If bad people can get in, and relatively being a good or a bad person isn't what makes you worthy, then how? What does the king mean when he speaks about the original guest being unworthy? Well, in this parable, what makes a person worthy to be at the wedding feast is their willingness to accept the invitation. What made the original group unworthy is not necessarily that they weren't law-abiding people. One guy owns a farm. One guy owns a shop. These aren't necessarily guys who are in the penitentiary, but they're just not interested. That's what made them unworthy. They were unwilling to come and celebrate the Son. And so we could say it this way about bad people. Bad people can come if they're willing to come on the king's terms. And that gets us into the last part of the story, because that is a lesson here too. Look at verse 11. But when the king came in to look over the dinner guests, he saw a man who was not dressed in wedding clothes. And he said to him, "Friend, how did you come in here without wedding clothes?" And the man was speechless. This is pretty tacky. A guy comes, he's not wearing the clothing he's supposed to. I like to picture this as a summer wedding, and I know this is not historically accurate, but I like to picture him unshaven in flip-flops and shorts and a ratty t-shirt with holes in it. I guess the point I would make in the middle of the story is this. It has to do with historical background. These people who came, they were gathered right off the street, right? The king had slaughtered his animals already. He needs to cook the meat. There's no refrigeration in this day, right? So we can't leave the ribeyes sitting out for days here. We got to cook it. They went out and in haste brought all these people into the wedding feast. So how is it that people come wearing the appropriate attire? Well, back in first century Israel, it was common for appropriate wedding clothes to be provided by the one who put on the wedding. And it wasn't just kings that did it. Historians said that wealthy and middle-class families often provided wedding clothes for the people who attended. Maybe a modern illustration of this would be my father's own generosity. When I got married to Brooke, my father graciously paid the rental fees for the tuxes that my sad, broke, 20-something groomsmen, you know, who were just starting their careers and couldn't provide for a family completely yet on one income. He paid the rental fee for their tuxes at my wedding. Just imagine that, but on a bigger scale than just the wedding party. They would provide the proper garments for guests. And this man, what you have here, is a man who refuses the attire that the king generously offered him. And that's why he's speechless. His silence shows he has no excuse. If he had an excuse, he would have given it. Everybody, including the bad people, had an opportunity to obtain garments that were proper for the occasion. And so what this man did was he basically said with his actions, I don't care about the occasion. I'm going to wear what I want to wear. And it's pretty tacky. It's pretty selfish that he did this. So, verse 13, the king said to the servants, bind him hand and foot and throw him into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's scary, and I think most of you understand that is a reference to hell. And so what's being talked about here? Well, there's going to be people who try to crash the wedding feast. There will be people who are invited to come, but they want to come on their own terms, wearing whatever they want to wear and not appropriate attire. And the wedding crashers are so bad, this is my interpretation, they're so bad, the king has to tie them up or they'll come right back in to the wedding feast. And this is the point. There will always be people who come to church, who want to hang around the church, be around the faith, be around the people of God, but who still want to get into the kingdom on their own terms. They're going to wear the garment of their own self-righteousness to the party instead of wearing the righteousness of Christ. And Jesus talked about these people actually at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. This is what he says about these wedding crashers at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. He says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name cast out demons and in your name perform many miracles? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. I think that when Jesus got to this point in the story where he talks about this man who won't wear the appropriate attire, I think his audience may have remembered Isaiah 61. Isaiah 61 was a messianic prophecy. Most people knew that passage. If you remember, I think it's Luke chapter 4. That's the passage Jesus goes to when he's in the synagogue at Nazareth. When he goes back home to his home synagogue, he teaches on Isaiah 61, I think it's verses 1 through 4. And if you read down further into the passage, into Isaiah 61 verse 10, listen to what the prophet says. I will rejoice greatly in Yahweh. My soul will exalt in my God, for he has clothed me in the garment of salvation. He's wrapped me with a robe of righteousness as a bridegroom decks himself with garland and a bride adorns herself with jewels. It's God who robes us with the righteousness of Christ. But if you reject that, to try to wrap yourself up in the robes of your own self-righteousness, and then try to get into the banquet, he's going to say to you, I never knew you. Depart from me. And this is a sober reminder that all are invited freely into the kingdom, but you have to come on the king's terms, not your own. And so to wrap up then with the parable, I think Jesus is saying this in essence. To the chief priests, the message is, God rejects you because you're rejecting the celebration of his son. And to the rest of the world, he says, come. You're invited, come. But if you come, you have to put on the garment of salvation I give you, not come in some sad homemade thing of your own creation. And then Jesus ends with these words, verse 14, for many are called, but few are chosen. Now let's break that down for a minute. Many are called. Many are invited. I mean, think about it. You have those original invitees who the king invited. Then you have all these people that he just invited in off the street. And those who were not worthy, let's think about those who were not worthy. They chose not to come either because of indifference or because of outright hostility. They murdered the king's slaves. Or some of them came, but one of them showed up not wearing the proper attire. And they all made their own decisions. Nobody forced them to make those decisions. They made those decisions freely and willingly. And so their exclusion from the kingdom is perfectly just. But the few who attend the celebration of the Son learn in time that the reason they're there is not because they were smarter or wiser than those other people, but because they were selected and drawn by the king. They were chosen by the king in a behind-the-scenes way. And this gets into the doctrine of predestination, election, God choosing those who are in the kingdom. And I assumed I probably wouldn't have much time to go into it, so I won't go too far into it here. But I wanted to just give you a book advertisement. There's a book, Chosen by God, by R.C. Sproul. This book is the one book that helped me more than any others. It helped all my logical concerns. He answered all my logical concerns and objections as I dealt with the doctrine of predestination and God choosing and electing people. And I think he takes you logically and biblically to a conclusion that you can feel very at home with, understanding man's responsibility and God's choice of, in electing those who will be his. I didn't want to go down a rabbit trail on election that ignores the main point of the story, but perhaps I could, in closing, sum it up this way. Let me simply say this. Those of you who are here, some of you, you've come this morning, but you may have a history of being indifferent to Christ. You're just interested in other things. Others of you might be hostile to him. You might be angry at God over something. And I would simply say to you this. God is inviting you to join in an eternal celebration of his Son. All he asks is that you come robed in the righteousness he provides as a free gift through faith in his Son Jesus. The invitation in this parable is not an invitation to suffering or deprivation or a monastic lifestyle. In fact, Jesus teaches against monasticism, I believe. This invitation is to the celebration of all celebrations. This is a happy invitation. It's a royal feast in honor of the Son. Won't you come?